the middle of the day, on the middle day of Sesshin. It's just like this. Chris said, wow, that's something, huh, that they're celebrating Bodhidharma's Day in such exuberant fashion. And I said, yeah, I didn't know that they knew about it. All around town, everyone's celebrating Bodhidharma's Day. All around the country, the world, in their own way. Some sit in the midday heat and sweat silently. Some sing and dance. Some go surfing. All according to one's wish. Does everyone trust themselves to do what's appropriate in the moment? Do we feel like we need some support? We need to rely on something outside ourselves, the cosmic wheels or the Buddha ancestors. Around this issue of trust or self-confidence, self-confidence in which we have to clarify what is the self in which we have confidence, and the self-confidence in which, as Nanette wonderfully pointed out, is not marked by any particular characteristics, like not making mistakes. If we only have self-confidence when we don't make mistakes, then that's kind of like relying on something external. When I think of this issue of self-confidence in Zen, I always think of Linji's instructions. Rinzai. Linji. Quite moving to me. He says this: when students today fail to make progress, where's their fault? The fault lies in the fact that they don't have faith in themselves, or they don't trust themselves. This character can be translated like faith, trust, or confidence. They don't have confidence in themselves. If you don't have faith in yourself, then you'll be forever in a hurry trying to keep up with everything around you. You'll be twisted and turned by whatever environment you're in, and you can never move freely. But if you could just stop this mind that goes rushing around moment by moment looking for something, then you'll be no different from the Buddhas and ancestors. Do you want to get to know the Buddhas and ancestors? They're none other than you! The people standing in front of me listening to this Dharma talk. Students don't have enough faith in themselves, so they rush around looking for something outside themselves. But even if they get something, all it will be is words and phrases, pretty appearances. they'll never get at the living thought of the ancestors. Make no mistake, followers of Zen, if you don't find it in this life, then for 1,000 kalpas, you'll be born again and again in the three realms, lured off by what you think are favorable environments, and be born in the belly of a donkey or cow. Make no mistake. Followers of the way, as I look at it, we are no different from Shakyamuni. In all our various activities each day, is there anything we lack? The wonderful light of the six sense faculties has never for a moment ceased to shine. If you could look at it this way, then you'd be the kind of person who has nothing to do for the rest of her life. The six sense faculties sure do shine, even when we're half asleep. They clearly discern Mexican music and the breeze through the window, and laughter and color. Sometimes when sitting, I feel like I'm not making much progress in the kind of concentration department. And then I get a little bit like, come on, the sesshin periods are ticking by. We're halfway through already for those doing the whole. And then sometimes surrender just comes to visit, and it's like not actually a matter of concentration, just a matter of like, is there a problem making self in the midst of it all? Is there a problem? I think the people dancing down the street don't make a problem out of not being like focused on their breath or something like this. Like they just, you know. So in a way they're more in accord with the Buddhas and ancestors. So if I start, you know, why should I make a problem of that? Don't think it's necessary, but we think, well, what are we supposed to be doing then? We could just go join their dance, and it's true, we could. Yeah. We have a chance to watch that pivot, that mind pivot. That's like, are you gonna make a problem here? Mm-hmm. Yes. I have the right to make a problem here. It's my birthright, and I'm gonna do it. Fine, go right ahead. Yeah. Good, got the problem. Because after all, we're Zen practitioners. There's a right way to be doing this. Isn't there? I mean, why go to all this trouble to take the time off and come to the Zendo and create this whole space to just like sit here and just let the six sense faculties just kind of like do their thing? How ridiculous. How joyful. So that's one sesshin practice I've been playing with a little bit is like that, like the problem maker, kind of like checking out the problem maker, how he does his thing, you know, trying to watch him. Now there's some things we really should make into problems, right? I mean, it would be like really negligent if we didn't, right?
Right.
I don't know. Do you have any? I think the ones that maybe often come up, actually, which it gets a little trickier in the conversation, is when they're not really about like our own little stuff, but like about the world at large. That's when I think it gets a little trickier, because then we can say, well, if I don't make a problem out of global warming, then it's just going to kill us all. No?
It doesn't help to make a problem. You can do all sorts of beneficial actions without making a problem. You're just responding to the situation.
Do you have? Can you have a strong motivation to respond without seeing it as a problem?
I think so.
Maybe it's we have.
Well, it's like you recognize harm. It's like when others are being harmed. If you recognize that you're causing harm or someone else is causing harm and respond, I think making it a problem is different. Not that I'm not expert at it. I don't necessarily.
Yeah, maybe a problem is when we really kind of like kind of push it into a little box and make it into something. There's a way to respond without making it into a problem. Maybe still there's some, you know, there's something that calls for being changed, like that, right? And then here's maybe another fine line between what's something calling to be changed and a problem.
Yeah. Maybe it's just language.
Maybe language, yeah. And I think there's a really kind of selfless response that's not about, it's not about, in a way I think global warming is not my problem. It doesn't feel like a narrow self-centered kind of thing. That's a difference too. It's like, it's larger than that. Like if our response to that could make it into my problem, and then I think it does detract from our response. But if it's more like, no, this is something large, it's not really about me, and my response to it is not really about me. It's just a larger issue that calls for a response. And then the response can be, we don't get dragged down by it either. Yeah.
I got something in the mail about this festival. Did Zen Center get something in the mail? Have we ever rescheduled it? It's so funny. It's like, it's just an opportunity to sit with Zendo and hear music.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, so I just kind of trained my attention to, oh, well, what are my physiological responses to hearing music? Where is the mind getting involved? Where am I just hearing?
Yeah.
Feeling my heartbeat faster. It's like, oh, some part of me is hooked into that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But there was this train of thought of like, wow, just so many things happened during such a change. Catherine's passing, the big devotion's passing, and those are things that occupy us. Unexpected.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always something. Even in the realm of sound, if it's not that sound, it's some other Saturday activity.
project.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I should have planned something over there because then we could have had surround.
Yeah. We were almost surrounded, yeah. A little refuge of silence, completely surrounded by activity that makes sound. And who would ever think twice that there's a bunch of people sitting in silence who are like taking it all in and, you know, having their experience touched by all of that. It's how we're all so connected. It's all kind of the mind. It's a little bit tricky because in a way it's like there we're bringing in some other time and place. It's a past. We're bringing in the past. So, but if it's a dominant thing that that affects us repetitively in the present, then it's also in the present. Yeah.
I mean, there's kind of a discernment there that's happening, but then you get caught up in it.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of how we turn stories. Like Liz was just saying, you know, like, well, but, you know, Sashin should be silent, the music, we could have done something different, and then just like, that whole story just turned in a different way. I'm like, well, there's just people playing music, and I'm just hearing it. It's the same event, exactly. That's an actual, you know, auditory event, but maybe there's a way to do that with the thought of some past harm. Same thing, like we're thinking about it in a certain way. We can only see it like, it shouldn't have happened that way. I can't forgive. It's either myself or another. Yeah. Yeah, all of that. We're seeing it in one certain way, and maybe there's another way to turn the whole thing. Almost like open up the container to a larger view of like interdependence. Like Thich Nhat Hanh has these beautiful poems about the boat people coming from in the little boats coming from Vietnam, and pirates attacking them, and these horrible situations, just torture, little girls being raped and things like that. And he's like, try to, you know, how to write a poem about that that frees himself from these things. His friends and went through such horrors, and as I recall, his poem is kind of like seeing in these like murderous pirates, like their just the conditions that made them who they are, and the connection between all these people and all their past generations of family who made them who they are and the circumstances of their lives, and that it opened up the story and made the story was much vaster. And is able to like have actually compassion for these ruthless murderers, just seeing how they are the way or their activities are the way that they are due to their own conditions.
And the trick there is not to feel responsible to change that.
Yeah, well, in a way we can't actually change anybody else ever. I think that's a big one. That's a hard one to actually really accept sometimes, especially people close to us or something. We feel like, well, there's some, I can, you know, help them to shift a little bit. I think that's like almost like the problem maker, almost the same thing, is to think that we could change anyone. Even, I mean, what's the bodhisattva vow then, right? It's a little tricky because we vow to help people be free from suffering. And yet, I think the way that we vow, bodhisattva vows to do that is not by like changing them exactly. It's more like relating to them in such a way that that change happens.
Right. It's not exposing the juggler either.
Exposing what?
The juggler.
Oh. Yeah, right. It's, you know, the response will be different in every situation. No special thing, but because we're also taking care of ourselves, with compassion for ourselves, what's the appropriate response? So Shishin is an interesting time to look at the past, even though maybe strictly speaking, we say really try to just keep returning to the present because the past is gone, and yet sometimes past comes up and we in our more aware mind of Sashin, we maybe can see the past in a different way. If it comes up and it doesn't drop away, then maybe we do have a chance to like work with it, not to figure it out, you know, but more like to widen the view. So, Fuyo Dao Kai, came to trust himself, not relying on the words of the ancient emperors anymore. Walked out. Dotsu said, "Wait a minute," but he didn't turn around. "Did you arrive at the realm of no doubt?" He covered his ears and kept walking. Later, Fuyo Dokai became head cook at Totsu's place, the Tenzo. Totsu, the teacher, said, "Taking care of the kitchen isn't easy." Fuyo Furong said, "Not at all." Do you agree, Tenzo-san? "It's not easy." "Not at all." Totsu said, "Do you boil the gruel, the oatmeal, and steam the rice?" Furong said, "Assistants sort the rice and light the fire. Workers boil the cereal and steam the rice." Totsu said, "Then what do you do?" And Furong said, "The master, in his compassion, has let him go, or has let him go free." So, Tenzo, Jika, Emily can, you don't have to do anything from now on. Thanks for all the work you've done so far this session. You don't have to cook any more meals. Just have your assistants do it. Yeah, so not the absent-minded attendants, assistants, but the one who looks a lot like you. That kind of assistant. Yeah. I think that's maybe what he's talking about here. It's hard to tell, as usual, in these stories. But, you know, assistants, like these ones, these assistants, they sort the rice and light the fire. Workers, like these ones, boil the gruel and steam the rice. What do you do? The teacher says. What do you do? The master, and it's not clear who's the master here. The master.
Who's saying the master?
Fuyo Dokai, the cook. The Tenzo is actually saying the master, and spent some time contemplating that. I don't think he means you. Often they talk like that. They say the master, meaning you, teacher. But I think he actually means like the host, your true master, your Buddha nature, in his compassion, has let him go. And him and master are both capitalized here. Him has let him go. Like there's, there's these assistants that are like my body, and five skandhas are our assistants, and they're doing all this kitchen work. And Tosa says, well, what do you, your true self, what do? The master, my true self, has let my true self go. So then for him, for her, it's not so difficult. The assistants get very tired, though, chopping all the vegetables and cutting the rice. But she has nothing to do. So maybe possible to work in the kitchen with that kind of spirit. There's somebody here who's like doing a lot of work and getting tired and a little stressed and like, what's the next, did I forget to do something? And all those assistants. And then there's like the host of your experience that has compassionately let herself go free. Never has to work again her whole life. One day, while Furong was attending Totsu, they walked around in the vegetable garden. Totsu handed him his staff, and he took it and followed. Maybe referring to like the teacher's staff. He hands it to a student. Student takes it and follows. Totsu, the student says, Totsu, the teacher says, this is how it should be. You're carrying my staff. Furong said, I don't consider it improper to carry your shoes or staff. To carry the teacher's shoes or staff. Totsu said, the teacher said, there is another walking with us. Another is capital A. There is another walking with us. Furong said, that person, capital P, person, doesn't take orders. Totsu, the teacher, left to rest. That evening, Totsu said to Furong, we still haven't finished our earlier talk. Furong said, please, master, say something. Totsu said, the sun comes up in the morning, the moon rises in the evening. Furong then lit a lamp. Totsu said, your actions are not futile. Furong said, if I am with you, this is how it should be. Totsu said, in whose house are there no servants? Furong said, the master is getting old, or you are getting old. It won't do to be without them. Kotsu said, "You're so obliging." Furong said, "It's my duty to repay kindness." Why do they have to talk this way? Keizan will later comment on this story. But even his commentary, I don't know how much it helps. They really, like, conversed in strange ways. Is this a translation language issue? Or did they really, like, is it this kind of highly symbolic kind of language that they're talking in? So Keizan says, "In this way, Furong thoroughly and meticulously clarified the great matter. The meaning of his question, the words of the Buddhas and ancestors are like ordinary rice and tea, but is there anything else apart from these to help people? The meaning of that is, do Buddhas and ancestors teach anything apart from their everyday life?" So, we kind of already talked about that some, but he says it very clearly. And maybe even more, so that it's not so much that their words are very ordinary. He makes it even bigger that the meaning of this question is, do the Buddhas and ancestors teach anything apart from just their ordinary everyday life? Because that's all we actually really see. It's just their ordinary everyday life. Do they teach something else besides that? Something about the cosmic wheels outside the sphere, the sky? Keizan says, "It sounds very much as if he were presenting his understanding by asking this question." He was actually presenting his understanding of how could they teach anything apart from their everyday life. However, Totsu asked, "Well, tell me, does the emperor's mandate in the kingdom depend on Yao, Shun, Yu, and Tang, the ancient emperors? Really, issuing orders now ultimately does not rely on the ancient emperors Yao and Shun. It's just that when one person is benevolent, the whole country of citizens is naturally blessed or benefited. In the same way, even if old Master Shakyamuni appeared in the world today and great Master Bodhidharma still lived, people should not rely on their power." The greatest of the great, if they Bodhidharma came into the room, we shouldn't rely on these others and at the expense of trusting ourselves. Like there's that other Tenzo story, right, of some Zen person's stirring the soup and Manjushri Bodhisattva suddenly appears on the rim of the soup pot, standing there. Should he drop all the kitchen work, prostrate to Manjushri, and ask for the true Dharma? Because it can't be here stirring the soup. This is Manjushri Bodhisattva. But the Zen story is, he just knocks him with a spoon into the pot, stirs him in, keeps cooking. It's going to be an excellent soup. Maybe the same point, actually. Yeah.
When you tell a woman in the middle of sashimi, you should go sit in the living room.
Manjushri, we're busy sitting, unless you want to follow the whole schedule with us. We're going to eat now. So you can go sit in the other room if you want.
But I hear they're having a good time down the street. So
yeah. You might like that, Manjushri. You maybe also heard the story about Manjushri one time he, something like he, it was the end of the practice period, and was it Mahakashapa, one of those Indian disciples of the Buddha, Subhuti or Mahakashapa, maybe Upali, he was the expert in the monastic regulations. Let's say it was Upali. And kind of like, you know, running the monastery and keeping order. At the end of the practice period, where nobody's supposed to leave, you're supposed to stay in one place for the whole practice period. So I am committing to not be gone overnight during our 2 annual Santa Cruz Warm Dual Temple practice periods. I might be gone overnight at other times afterwards. But I'm trying to arrange my life like that. So Manjushri showed up kind of like at the end of the practice period, and say Upali or whoever this was like, well, where were you the whole practice period? 3 months is over. Where did you spend the practice period? And Manjushri said, in the brothels and wine shops. And Upali said, well, then it's time for punishment. You broke the rules. So you took out the stick or something to strike him. And suddenly Manjushri multiplied into thousands and thousands of Manjushris, and said, well, which Manjushri are you going to punish? Something like that. It's another story about Manjushri. Dogen has a Shobogenzo essay called Shobogenzo Kajo, Everyday Activity, Ordinary Life, Everyday Activity, where he says, in the domain of the Buddhas and ancestors, drinking tea and eating rice is everyday activity. This having tea and rice has been transmitted over many years and is present right now. Thus, the Buddha ancestor's vital activity of having tea and rice comes to us. He's always talking about, you know, the great matter that's being transmitted by the ancestors, and he calls it many different things, like the ancient mirror. And here he says this great matter that's being transmitted is having tea and rice. Ordinary activity is the great matter that's being transmitted by the Buddhas and ancestors. And then he quotes this whole story of Totsu and Daokai. Have you reached the ground of no doubt? And Daokai covered his ears and left. Dogen says, from this you should clearly understand that the thoughts and words of Buddha ancestors are their everyday tea and rice. Ordinary coarse tea and plain rice are Buddha's thoughts and ancestors' words. Because Buddha ancestors prepare tea and rice maintain Buddha ancestors. Accordingly, they need no powers other than this tea and rice, and they have no need to use powers as Buddhas and ancestors. The powers that they use as Buddhas and ancestors is ordinary tea and rice. You should investigate and study the expression, does he need the ancient emperors Yu, Tang, Yao, and Shun? You should leap over the summit of the question, besides tea and rice, are there any other words for helping people? You should try to see whether leaping is possible or not. leap over the summit of that question. Besides tea and rice, are there any words to help people?
Leaping.
Leaping lizards. When you just affirm and authenticate it yourselves without relying on Shakyamuni and Bodhidharma, you will become it completely. Therefore, if you try to add some flavor when you explain the truth, you end up seeing it as another and do not escape plotting and scheming. That is why Totsu struck Furong in the mouth with his whisk when he started to speak, in order to show him that he was perfect right from the beginning, with nothing lacking. He said, "When you gave way to thought, you immediately deserve 30 blows." This is not confirmation of understanding, but to show him this. So we might think that was maybe a little bit aggressive to hit him in the mouth and say, "You deserve 30 blows." But Keizan says, this was to show him that he was perfect right from the beginning with nothing lacking. It's kind of like, you know, you are so okay. You don't need to say anything to improve on yourself at all. It's the spirit of this. Once you give way to thought, Keizan says, trying to decide what mind is or what Buddha is, you deny yourself and look elsewhere. Even though you can say the entirety is revealed, or it is naturally bright, or you speak of mind, nature, Zen, or the way, you have not at all escaped plotting and scheming. If there is plotting and scheming, then immediately there are clouds for 10,000 miles, and you will be deluded about yourself for a long time. Even if I were to give you not just 30 blows, but strike you in life after life for 10,000 eons, it would be hard for you to escape your offenses. It's a bit hard. Just, you know, it's not that bad to say Zen or mind. Keizan says, he's just making this point that to not try to do anything about anything. Dao Kai was awakened at the words of Totsu. He made bows and left without even turning around when called. When asked, "Have you reached the realm of no doubt?" If you ask, what's the need to reach the realm of no doubt? Then you're separated from it by 10,000 miles of obstructing mountains. So there's always... we can't fall, we can't settle in anywhere here. You know, have you reached the realm of no doubt? We might think, well, at this point, you know, what's even the point? Where's the need to reach the realm of no doubt? Why even bother with the question? Then you're separated from it by 10,000 miles of obstructing mountains. So we can't fall into that kind of complacency either. When we hear the words of the Buddhas and ancestors with our ears, they defile our ears at once. That we cleanse our ears for 1,000 lives, over 10,000 eons, we cannot get them clean. After this session, it's going to take more than 10,000 eons to clean our ears. Therefore, Dao Kai covered his ears, not letting in one word. Before he had experienced this realm fully, when he was the Tenzo head cook, he said, "The master has set him free." Here he clarifies, "he," in quotes, "the master has set him free." He, is not the one who steams rice, nor the one who gathers vegetables. Therefore, carrying firewood and water is something for workers and laborers to do, not the true head cook. Talking about himself. This is not kind of practical instructions about temple roles. It's talking about, the true self. Though he never seems to stop rolling up his sleeves and scrubbing pots through the 24 hours, ultimately he never does anything, nor does he come in contact with things at all. Therefore, Dao Kai spoke of setting him free. You get a sense of that? I think that's one of the stories that is a little more clear than others here and quite helpful. I think it applies to our practice of taking care of the Zendo and sitting Zazen and bowing, all these things. There's someone who is doing those things, but there's someone who's not doing any of them. It's not really that they're that separate. It's a way of talking to make the point that there's someone, not a person, but someone who's just at rest all the time, not doing anything, even in our busy, tiring activities. You know, immediately then we can think that, oh, there's a separation then. There's some essence of self that's not doing anything while the body and mind does things. But there's no essence of true self. And yet there's just the free flow itself is not busy. We also call it that, right? There's one who's not busy, even while sweeping. It's the same one here who doesn't scrub the pots when the assistants are scrubbing the pots. The busy assistants are scrubbing the pots. There's someone who doesn't. Although he had experienced it like this when they went to the vegetable garden, Totsu tried to get him to mature his insight. He handed him his staff. The master took it and followed along. The teacher said, "This is the way it should be." He showed Furong that the staff was not something a priest ought to carry himself, that there was someone who does not carry things. It's kind of the same point here, according to Keizan. You know, you take the staff because there's someone here who's doesn't carry anything. And Dao Kai's insight was ripened. Therefore, he said, "I don't consider it improper to carry your shoes and staff." Even though he knew what moved its toes in the priest's shoes and carried the staff, he still retained a little doubt in understanding that extending one's hand and moving one's feet was not improper. So Totsu tested him, saying, "There is another walking with us." This gets a little strange, and I don't know how much time we should spend on it, because it's a bit obscure, I think. But I'll share Thomas Cleary's translation, which just goes to show that this is highly interpretable, this kind of stuff. And he turns it a little bit. He says, Totsu, the teacher's toes moved inside his shoes, and like almost like he had some energy around what was happening here. And while he knew that Dao Kai had taken up the staff, he had some suspicion that Dao Kai still had the understanding that any activity is not out of place. So he tested him again by saying, there is still another accompanying. Anybody like following this closely and be like, wow, cool. If so, please enlighten me. I'm going to continue, if you don't mind. Although I also will say that I'm sorry I didn't make copies for you all, because sometimes this stuff is a lot to absorb, and if you kind of read it like several times, it starts to turn in new ways. I think all things are like this, actually, but maybe especially the Zen stories. So I think the central cases are kind of nice to memorize. They're usually pretty short and simple, the central story. Sometimes if I feel like I don't have any entrance into it, I'm just like, well, let me just read it a few times, kind of remember the gist, kind of picture the two characters talking back and forth, and then I have it in Zazen, right? And then in the middle of Zazen, sometimes I'll just, you know, bring it up and check it out again. It's not really like koan practice, I don't think, but maybe some aspects like that. Just like a few hours later or on a new day, and after sitting some, I'll just, you know, recite the same story to myself and feel like, oh yeah, there's something that's beautiful. There is a point here, after all. However, there was something that Dao Kai had not yet achieved. Why? Even though he knew that there was someone who does not join you when you extend your hand and who's not affected when you move your feet. It's kind of, now we're talking about that, the one who's not busy. He understood the one who's not busy. If this was the extent of his understanding, there was still some doubt. Therefore, Totsu went to take some rest without getting to the bottom of the truth. That night, he told Furong, we still haven't finished our discussion. At that time, Furong knew of its existence and that it was beyond doubt. It, we're talking about it, or that one. Feeling that there was nothing he had not reached, he said, please, teacher, say something. And Totsu said, the sun comes up in the morning, the moon rises in the evening. Keizan says, surely the night deepens, stars move, and the moon is darkened. White clouds spread across the many mountains so that they're hidden. However, there is a sun that rises that's not one of them. The sun sinks behind the western hills, and the many forms are unseen. Although no one comes and goes, and the road cannot be discerned, there is also something that is not emptied out. Therefore, the moon comes out. Still these same sort of dialectics of, if we start to think, we're talking about a realm of vast nothingness, then he says, there is something here. Something inconceivable that's the source of life.
That's the moon coming out?
In this case, the moon coming out. Mm-hmm. Although in this realm everything is the same and unalloyed with anything else, and nothing else is seen or heard, it is something naturally clear and bright. The moon. It illuminates the darkness at once. Therefore, Furong lit a lamp. Is this just Keizan just kind of making up his take on this? Maybe. Or maybe it's really clear. And I'm feeling dense. But it works as a story, I think. The lamp is like, there's something here. It illuminates the darkness at once. Therefore, Furong lit a lamp. This showed that he'd really arrived there and seen it fully. Totsu said, "Your actions are not futile. When Daokai became familiar with this realm, there was no time during the day and night for being lax in his concentrated efforts." He said, "If I am beside you, this is how it should be." Although he had seen it fully, he seemed to understand it as the wonderful functioning of the self. Therefore, Totsu tested him again, saying, "In whose house are there no servants?" "Who has no servants to use?" Furong said, "You're getting old. It won't do to be without them." So we could hear this as also like kind of like the host and guests, the master and the servants. They always go together. There is somebody, there's some assistants always chopping the vegetables and making the soup, and there's one who's not doing anything, who's already been set free at the same time. Therefore, in whose house are there no servants? Who has no servants to use? So the world of form and appearance. There is someone, capital S, who is venerable and eminent and who does not mingle with the dust of the world. That body is wonderfully bright and ultimately not separate from oneself. Furong said, "It won't do to be without servants." Coming to see it like this, he cannot be said to have not reached it exactly. So Totsu said, "You're so obliging. For eons and eons, he, capital H, she, capital S, it, capital I, let's say it, or she, let's say she to make it more personal. For eons and eons, she has supported us and never left us. We have received her kindness for a long time. If you try to compare her kindness, even Mount Sumeru is not as large. If you try to compare her virtue, not even the four oceans and nine continents can equal it. The reason is that Mount Sumeru, the sun and moon, the great ocean, and the rivers all move and change with time. But the kindness of this old teacher, of her kindness never takes on form or ceases to exist. There's never a time when we do not receive her kindness. If we're born in vain and die in vain without once paying our respects to that venerable face, then as unfilial people we will flounder in the ocean of birth and death for a long time. How do we pay our respects to that venerable face? You could say Sashin is a week of just paying our respects to her, sitting upright and aligning ourselves with her body and mind, not adding or subtracting anything. We pay our respects most directly and lovingly. Otherwise, we're kind of unfilial children to our great mother. If you are thorough and see her sufficiently, you will utterly repay the vast kindness of 1,000 lives and 10,000 eons. Therefore, Daokai said, "I must repay kindness." Having seen this so precisely in such a way, when he took up residence as a teacher and a monk asked, "A foreign flute does not use the five tones Does anyone know what tartar means? Like tartar sauce? What's that?
The Tartars, don't they
marauding hordes
of people?
Could be. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I forgot to look it up. One translation says, a Tartar flute, and another says, a foreign flute. I don't know if Tartar means foreign. Maybe it's a particular kind of flute that's not a Chinese flute from some other culture. So this, you know, an African flute does not use the five tones of classical Chinese music, but its sound fills the dark night. Please, Master, play it. So this is Furong Daokai is now teaching, and the student says, an African flute doesn't use the same like scale and tone as Chinese flute, but its sound fills the dark night. Please, teacher, play it for me. Play this African flute. Furong said, a wooden rooster crows at midnight, an iron phoenix cries at dawn. Sounds a little bit like a Chinese flute to me. The monk said, in that case, then a single note includes 1,000 ancient songs. All the monks in the hall know the sound. Furong said, even a tongueless child can continue it. We also, in Zen, we also have the iron flute with no holes, except the solid iron flute with no holes. And we say, Zen practice is like that, playing the solid iron flute with no holes. Or like a mosquito biting an iron bowl. The sound is exquisite from this flute. Or like the gateless barrier. They had all of these wonderful phrases for doing the impossible. Stop the sound of the temple bell on the next mountain right now. These are like, you know, the request to the Zen practitioner. Maturing like this, no green hills blocked his eyes, no clear stream washed his ears. Fame and fortune were like dust in his eyes. Seeing forms and hearing sounds were like planting flowers on a stone. Finally, he never left the monastery, nor did he attend feasts. He did not care if people came or if they went. This is all talking about Fuyo Dokai, this great reviver of Soto Zen. This is part of his strictness. He's just like, really let go. Like, you know, I'm just here. Like, whatever is totally fine. I think that's the spirit. Like, so what? Oh, there's lots of people. Oh, there's hardly anyone. It's like planting flowers on a stone. His community was never fixed in size, sometimes large, sometimes small. They ate only one bowl of gruel a day. If there was not enough, they had it thinned with hot water. The essential teachings of the Soto school flourished at this time. Furong had an intimate view of the Dharma and made no errors in guarding it. Therefore, he never forgot what former teachers had entrusted him with. Even though he heeded the counsel of the enlightened ones of antiquity like this, he still said, "You cannot use this mountain monk's conduct as an example. I am ashamed to be the master of this monastery. How can I be here wasting the communal goods of the community and so quickly forget what the former teachers entrusted me with? Now every time I try to emulate the former abbots, and every time this mountain monk speaks of the doings of the sages of old, I am aware that I have no hiding place. I am ashamed of how soft and weak the successors have become. This was his spirit. This is, as we heard earlier, that, Thomas Cleary said, Kazan's style is not to boost his prestige by being connected with these ancient great ones, but actually to bring forth the prestige of the ancient great ones to show his own shame and unworthiness. Shame is one of the great tools of Japanese psychology, something like that. So I think this is an example here of Furyo Dokai is doing that. It's just being humble. I think it's Dogen also revering the ancients, which is kind of interesting because this one he's saying, how can my practice today, it's so embarrassing to like talk to you people about practice when I bring up these stories of these great ancient ancestors. But he's the one who awakened to, do we need these teachings of these ancients to help people today? Interesting, huh? It's almost like the opposite. So maybe there's just both these sides are valid. No, we don't need the ancients to manifest the practice in the present moment, trusting ourselves completely, and lest we get a little bit maybe inflated or something there, then let's remember the greatness of these ancients and keep our effort alive out of great respect for them and repay their compassionate kindness. So Furyo Dokai, I mentioned that there's this text that's by Furyo Dokai that is sometimes chanted in Japanese Soto monasteries. I've never heard it chanted in America. Maybe at No Abode Hermitage, once in a while we pulled this one out, because we were kind of trying to practice kind of in this spirit of Furyo Dokai in this very simple way. So this was like encouraging to me especially at that time in my life. It's really about renunciation. It's called the Standards of Jetavana. So the Jetavana, or the Jeta Grove, is one of the places where Shakyamuni Buddha hung out and taught a lot. So he's kind of saying the standards of the Buddha's practice places of the Jeta Grove is like this for us Chinese Zen people. Home leavers, monks, those who leave home, but we could say renunciates, to apply to any one leaving their the nest of attachment. Renunciates are those who are disenchanted with worldly toil and seek liberation from birth and death. So rest your mind, stop worrying, and cut off clinging involvements. That's why you're called renunciates. How can you receive luxurious offerings and be immersed in ordinary life? You must let go of this, that, and everything in between. Regard whatever you see and hear as flowers planted on a rock. When you encounter fame and gain, regard them as dust in your eyes. It hurts. So So he's speaking to a community of renunciates. Right? So maybe a little bit much for us, but just so you get the feeling of Fuyo Dokai. It's not that this hasn't ever been experienced or known from beginningless time, but we still continue to turn the head into the tail. Why should you suffer with greed and attachment? If you don't stop longing now, when will you? Thus the ancient sages teach you to let go right at this very moment. If you do so, what will remain? If you attain contentment of mind, Buddhas and ancestors will be like something extra, like his awakening. And all the things in the world will be inevitably cool and plain. Only then can you merge with the place of suchness. Don't you see? Longshan did not see anyone throughout his life. Jiaozhou did not speak one phrase throughout his life. Biandan gathered chestnuts for his meals. Dame made his robe from lotus leaves. The paper-robed wayfarer only wore paper. Senior monk Xuan Tai only wore cotton. Shi Xuan built a dead tree hall and lived there with the assembly, nobody ever lying down. What you need to do is to let your mind perish. Totsu, his teacher, asked his students to prepare the rice, then he cooked and ate together with them. Thus, what you need to do is minimize your concerns. So, like that, some of these things I think really do apply to us, right? Whatever kind of life we're living, he's saying, what we really need to do is like minimize our concerns. That's a good one, I think. And then he's, you know, in his particular case, this is how they did it. It's like, this is how the ancient sages encouraged themselves. Had they not thought their practices worthwhile, they would not have bothered to simplify their daily activities. Good people, if you realize this with your whole body, you will be a person of no lack. If you don't take it up, I feel you will fear that you will waste your effort in the future. This mountain monk, so this is part of what Kazon's quoting here, where he says, this mountain monk has become the head of this temple in spite of having achieved nothing worth mentioning. How can I sit on the seat and use up the community's provisions in vain, neglecting the bequest of the ancient sages? I want to follow the example of the teachers of old in acting as abbot. After consulting with all of you, we have decided not to leave the monastery, attend feasts, or ask for donations. So this is his kind of like he describes his practical thing here. It's kind of interesting because you could say this is the dilemma in the modern world of Buddhism and the ancient world. Should we ask for donations? Should we charge fees? Well, in this case, we all, and it's nice because he says, we all together decided, he actually didn't just decide on his own. Together we all decided, okay, let's, you know, if we ask for donations, then we're maybe like, we'll have some obligations and it'll make our life complicated, so let's actually, to simplify it, let's not bother. But we happen to have some rice fields, so they could do this kind of thing. We will divide 1 year's harvest from our rice fields into 365 days and use them accordingly. This is this kind of famous thing that of Furong that Dogen likes to explain to. That maybe this creative idea they had, maybe the only ones that had, okay, we're going to like, I guess last year's rice harvest, we're going to like, here's our giant pile of dried rice for this year. We're going to divide it into 365 equal portions. And sometimes there's a lot of people here and sometimes there aren't, but this is the portion for the day, no matter how many people are here. They just, I guess, to simplify, right? Otherwise it's going to be like, how are we doing? How's our stock going? We know exactly we're going to have this much every day for the year. And then, if there's hardly anybody here, we can all have several bowls of rice. And if there's a lot of people here, then we're gonna have to water it down more and more. But we won't use tomorrow's portions.
How about saving yesterday's portions if you have not enough people?
Yeah, we would think that, right?
From that's how I would think.
Yeah, from our logical point of view, but it seems like. This is a funny, quirky little anecdotal story of he's explaining how what we decided to do together now. And I hear it as like, we're just really not going to get involved in, like, you know, saving or anything like this. I think that's how I would understand it. It's like, yeah, we could save this because actually, there's a rumor that there's going to be like several hundred people here next week. But like, let's not think about next week. Just like, eat today's rice.
Isn't that on one of the lists of renouncing, like, you know how there's all these lists of seven harsh.
Yeah.
To not save anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or is it, you know, in the
Vinaya? Yeah, it is. In fact, yeah, it's in the Vinaya. Even just for the ordinary monk's rules in Theravada, you can't save any food overnight.
That's what I was saying. So you get your food for the day, and you can't.
Yeah. So eat as much as you can. If there's leftovers, feed the birds, yeah. I mean, in a monastery, it's a little bit... You can get around it a little bit because, you know, you can... If they cook a huge meal and it's kind of like maybe like places like in California, the Theravada monastery, there's lay supporters who don't have to follow those precepts. They can like cook the meal, serve it to the monks. The monk can't take anything back to their room or anything, but then they can gather the leftovers and serve it the next day like that, as long as it's not the monks doing it. But if you're living out in the forest, I think in the Buddhist time, it was just you collect your alms for the day, you just go out and you're living with the other monks in the forest, then I think it is you feed it to the birds. I think then they still do that. Ajahn Chah talks about that. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. A life art for them, to us, it looks already really simple already.
Yeah.
But they're like, it's how can we simplify even more? Yeah. Yeah, coming up with a program, a kind of plan. You could say, well, it is kind of thinking about the future if we're dividing this all up, but then maybe you just have your little bags of rice, 365 bags of rice or something, and you're just like, now we've done that, now like, okay, like forget about food for the year now. We've done it on New Year's Day. We've finished with our decisions about this. So we will not increase the amount each day according to the number of people in the assembly. When there's enough to make boiled rice, we will do so. When there's not enough rice, we'll make gruel by adding water. When there's even less rice, we'll make rice water. When we welcome new monks, we will serve ordinary tea and no snacks. Tea will be made ready in the tea room for all to serve themselves. And maybe this was because the etiquette in the monasteries there in the old days maybe was like, if a monk comes, there's a whole person whose job it is to serve them tea. And it's kind of like, well, let's like not even bother, let's just have a tea area like we do here. Help yourself, like that. No special etiquette. We will do only what is essential, eliminating all the rest, in order to concentrate on wholehearted practice of the way. Here, life activity is abundant and the landscape is not lacking in beauty. Flowers blossom and birds sing. Wooden horses whinny and stone oxen run. Green mountains far away are faint, and the gurgling spring nearby is soundless. Monkeys on the mountain ridges chatter, and dew moistens the midnight moon. A little bit like Tassajara, maybe, especially in the winter, and the waterfalls start to run, and there's not many people around. Just the beauty of nature. When we simplify our lives, we notice the beauty of nature. It's kind of like talking about all this austerity, and then he says, here, life activity is abundant, and the landscape's full of beauty. So it's not like we're like, oh man, we're just rice water again today. It's like we live in the beautiful realm. Cranes call in the forest and the breezes swirl around the pines at dawn. When the spring wind rises in a dead tree, a dragon howls. At the time of falling leaves, the shivering forest scatters blossoms. The jade steps are spread with moss patterns. Human faces take on shades of mist. Sounds are serene. Remote from worldly affairs, this one taste is subtle. There's no way to approach it. Today, this mountain monk is supposed to present the gate of the house to all of you. Kind of like, I'm supposed to give a Dharma talk about Zen teachings. All this is already off track. Even so, I go on lecturing and giving instructions in a Dokusan room. I take up a mallet and raise a whisk. I shout to the east and strike in the west. I raise my eyebrows and glare my eyes like a lunatic. I feel as if I'm actually belittling you, students, and betraying the ancient sages and putting on this Zen show. Don't you see? Bodhidharma came from India, got to the foot of Shaoxer Peak and faced the wall for 9 years. The second ancestor stood in the snow and cut off his arm. What hardship! Bodhidharma did not say a word, and the second ancestor did not ask a question. But can you say Bodhidharma did not teach others? Can you regard the second ancestor as not seeking a teacher? Whenever I speak about examples of ancient sages, I feel there's no place to hide. I am ashamed that we who come later are so soft and weak. These days, people make exotic and delicious meal offerings of 100 flavors for each other, saying, food, clothing, bedding, and medicine must be sufficient before we will feel ready to arouse the mind of awakening. The Buddha said, these are the four requisites. We need food, clothing, bedding, and medicine. Everybody needs. So people may be quoting the Buddha like, well, we need these four requisites before we like get to work on the practice, so shouldn't we ask for donations? Or something? We need some basic sustenance. Before we feel ready to arouse this deep intention to practice. But I fear that such people as us do not know how to move their hands and feet and will be separated from the reality of birth and death and the world. Time flies like an arrow and our regret may be deep. There have been times when others have been awakened due to their merit, but this mountain monk is not forcing you to follow my advice. Have you seen this verse by a teacher of old? The verse, our meal is foxtail millet from mountain fields. For vegetables, we have faded yellow pickles. Eat them if you like. Otherwise, you're free to go, east or west. please, fellow wayfarers, may each of you be diligent. Take care. Fu Rong Gao Kai, the reviver of the Chinese Soto lineage. And I think there's in modern Japanese Soto Zen, they appreciate his words enough to chant that in sometimes in the monasteries. I don't think it maybe would chant very well, except the parts about the spring breezes around the pines at dawn. But part about how you divide up your rice and create the tea areas and stuff. I don't know. So, I sympathize. I resonate with Fu Rong Dao Kai. I can understand his sense of shame and when hearing of these ancestors. I can feel such a way myself, and regret. My greed, hate, and delusion. I don't like to ask for things. I recently made a request, kind of asking for some stuff, and I've been thinking about it since, and feel like in my heart, feel like not so great about it. Yes.
I was just thinking of how you would see today's Zen, the way that we really don't know how to divide the rice up.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I think when hearing this kind of thing, it's hard to know. Yeah. Can we really practice like these ancients? And even in the monasteries, even at, Tassajara, kind of like a model Zen monastery, are they really trying to live simply, but still not quite like these ancients? It's a question. I think it's an interesting, maybe kind of big topic. Sometimes I think it's like, sometimes I think of it as, how far do we want to go with this practice? That maybe off, but I think of that for myself. And as American culture, as Japanese, as basically all spiritual practice around the world, how far does anyone want to take it? And sometimes I imagine that these ancients were just like, they see. I think one has to have some pretty deep insight already into like the illusoriness of the world to otherwise it's just a bunch of like hard pain. But if one really kind of starts to see through, and then like, well, what are we really doing? What do we want to do? And what's What is the Buddha offering? Then that's how I think for myself sometimes. How far do I want to go? And I confess that in my youth, in my first arousing the intention to practice as a young man, it's a different time of life. I sometimes would feel at least on the edge of feeling like that's what I, with this life I want to like take this practice as far as it will go. I want to confirm all the Buddha's teachings directly, and because what else is there to do? And like, let's do it. And I notice as I get older that maybe quite naturally, but that spirit kind of fades, and not necessarily a bad thing, because other spirit comes in. There's other points to be made, and some might say that this kind of practice is a little bit like Zen teacher, but that emphasis is a little bit small vehicle, maybe, like individual liberation. It's not about like how can we benefit others. No, we might argue and say it is actually. In Furong's monastery, it's like we all come here to like give everything to this project of practice and realization. So let's you know, encourage each other to go all the way like that. Possible to be fooling oneself too. So it's a question for me. I still, this is one of my kind of like heart koans maybe, or questions, and watching my own life over these decades, and coming even to you know, when I was at Tassajara in the monastery for all these years, I would often feel like life's too complicated here. I really, if I want to practice the way I would sometimes feel inspired, I have to go off into the mountains alone and just where there's nothing to be done except just, you know, 24 hour just like focus on this. I'm getting distracted all the time in the monastery, right? And then and people in the past sometimes would do that, right? And now having left the monastery and being in this kind of more village type Zen temple is interesting too. I notice how the setting that we're in really does affect us, no matter how strong our intention, our surroundings. You know, that's why we all know this. That's why we create sessions and practice periods. We set up the environment to be really conducive to practice. The world's job is to like come in on us and say like, forget about your practice, like be a consumer and get as distracted as you can. Come on, we're all rooting for you. So a little sangha like this, where we're like, wait a second, I think there's something else we have to remember here. This is how we support each other. Our little group here, in Sashin especially, right? It was like, wow, we know there's some value in this kind of life. Sometimes we forget and it gets hard, and what are we doing here? But I think we know. And we make the effort to come together like this and support each other. In the Abhidharma lists of mental factors and mental qualities, and you know, 51 or 175 qualities of mind that make up a mind. Sometimes they're certain sections are classified into wholesome and unwholesome dharmas, and you know, there may be some question about how exactly we translate these terms, but the term is often translated as shame. I think it's not the same as like guilt, but shame in the sense of like maybe almost like conscience, I might say, is classified as a wholesome dharma. It's a positive thing, actually, because it it encourages our practice. It keeps us confessing, repenting, and moving forward. So sometimes I feel some shame about my own practice, and I feel like not so bad about that. It's a kind of a sweet feeling. I feel all kind of encouraged by that feeling. So it's dangerous. It can flip into like self-deprecation or guilt or like I'm unworthy and worthless, despicable me. Yeah. And if it goes into like that, then I think it's not a wholesome quality. So it's a fine line. Or is it just enough, and not really even, I think with the self, the whole self-identity thing doesn't get too involved, and it's just like, oh, this feeling of like this continuum of body and mind. I vow to like step back onto the path because I've strayed a little bit off. I think we can do that without feeling like bad, actually. Any final words? It's kind of a somber note, you know.
I have a little story.
Yes.
My mother tells this great story. I just love it. My mother lived during the Depression. She had one dress. She wore that dress every day. That's all she had.
Mm.
At the end of the Depression, she got a second dress. She had great problems. Now, she never knew what to wear. She didn't have enough.
With two dresses,
it was now a problem. Every day was a problem.
That's a great story. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Sashin, we really like, we make things easy in that way. We don't give ourselves so much choice, and it makes things easier. There's not a lot of decisions to make. Like, should I go to the toilet during this kinhin or the next one? It's not that big a thing. Maybe this one. Yeah. So, like Tassajara, that people discovered that one was like a little bit of a, there was a little bit too, it made people too confused. Actually, it's true. That like people got too distracted by whether to go outside or inside during kinhin. So they actually said it at one point, only go out to use the toilet, otherwise just stay in the Zendo, or we'll all go out together. Yeah, interesting, huh? So I was like this thing that already seems so simple, let's like adjust it even a little bit more. May all beings benefit from our strange practice. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.